Contrary to popular wishes, we haven't all been forced to convert the herd to Objective-C. This is episode 10 of the Tux Radar podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
And I'm Graham Morrison.
And we're releasing a new podcast every 2 weeks, like always, available for free from tuxradar.com, where we also publish news, features, and more. So bookmark it today. And of course, there's a fantastic Linux format subscriptions deal. It's cheap, it's great, go and buy it now at tinyurl.com/podcastlxf. In this episode, Unix is now 40 years old, plus there's a Google Chrome alpha release finally on Linux. The hot topic is Ben Guger from Google had a go at Linux development a few months ago. We're asking, is it really that bad? And Open Ballot, is it time we cut the number of licenses?
So, Unix is 40 years old.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday. 40 years since Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie chipped in together and wrote their little assembler and editor and the basis of what we use today. And the basis of what's in millions of mobile phones now as well.
Most importantly, yeah.
it's unbelievable. So, well, what's the biggest achievement then? 40 years.
OS 10.
That's one way of looking at it, yes. Will Unix be around in another 40 years?
Probably, yeah, running on some server somewhere that everyone's forgotten about.
Is Unix still really around today? Or has it been replaced so many times?
It all depends on your definition, doesn't it? A lot of people say, you know, one of the things is in Unix everything is a file. And even today you can still access just about every system resource through the Unix file system, through sys and proc.
In my filing cabinet, everything is a file. That doesn't really make it Unix.
True. If it doesn't have a proper GUI, then it's Unix, yeah.
Unix is in that film with the dinosaurs. That's an achievement.
Yeah, Jurassic something, wasn't it? I remember that.
What about the letter X? I think Unix is responsible for the letter X being so prevalent in the computing industry, and the letter X seems to be doing very, very well.
It does, yeah.
And that's not down to Apple, then. Well, coming back to this recurring theme we've got going on here.
If Apple have inherited the letter X from Unix, then that's progress.
It's a good letter.
It's definitely a Sesame Street episode, this one, isn't it?
Number 40, the letter X.
Does that mean that Fedora 11 is some sort of Unix midlife crisis?
Because it's gone past?
It's 40, you know, it's on the anniversary, pretty much.
Yeah, presumably it will try and buy a sports car to compensate for its other failings in life. And
that only
holds true if operating system years are analogous to human years. What if they're more like dog years? What if Unix isn't having a midlife crisis at all? What if it's like 150?
This is a very good point, and I think all listeners should try and give some sort of post a comment and tell us how many Unix years is equivalent to one human year.
Please. So Unix is still in its adolescence.
It could be, or it could be a very old person.
An old man, yeah.
Could be. About to die.
Well, I remember reading an essay from Jeremy Arson. I think it was in Open Sources, the O'Reilly book, I don't remember. When he was making the point that the skills he learned 15 years ago on Windows are now basically useless, because they move on so fast. Whereas the skills he learned 15 years ago on Unix are pretty much valid still. All the same C function calls are still there, still the same sorts of things.
Perhaps at a fundamental level, yeah.
Yeah, at a fundamental level, yeah. But I wonder whether that's going to carry on holding true or not, because, you know, things like Dbus are now pretty much everywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, they weren't around a few years ago. They're moving on, you know. iNotify? DNotify? I don't know which one they chose in the end. You know, that's new technology. You know, libfam's gone.
Well,
they are moving on.
You know, 5 years ago, you could have said you were really in tune with the Linux audio systems, and then Tools Audio comes along. So, yeah, but that's just the progress of technology, isn't it? If still ultimately your basic standard C library program from the 70s should compile and run pretty similar today.
We should try that.
Let's try it. Let's find like the original version of the VI editor and
Vi
and build it. I don't think I've ever said that out loud in my life, the name of that editor. Also in the news, Google Chrome. There's now an alpha version for Linux. Has anybody tried it yet?
I have, actually.
Have you?
Yeah.
What's it like?
It's really good. I mean, it's lacking flash support, which is probably the biggest omission.
Right.
So I can't spend the whole day watching YouTube.
Damn it.
With Chrome. I still have to have Firefox open. But in quick tests, with scouring my Gmail and Google Docs and things like that that it's designed for, it's much quicker than anything else on my desktop.
Does it launch quicker as well?
Yeah, it does. It does. It's a bit, it's different to the Windows version in that you can't get rid of the window border. So you've still got KWin wrapped around it. You can get rid of that in KWin, but then you can't drag the window around with the blue background on Chrome like you can on Windows. But that's just a small thing.
I thought it was some sort of window manager hint you can set in your code to
you can to get rid of it. But, yeah, but then there's nothing in Chrome to let you move the window, for example, without holding down the Alt key, which is one of your tips from our last podcast. But yeah, I think it's a great alpha. It hasn't crashed on me.
Really?
Mm.
Well, presumably it's mostly the same code.
Yeah, yeah.
With just with the actual GTK parts being different.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is very impressive. The fact that it runs so damn fast and it's so far from release too.
Yeah.
That it just makes you question so many things.
Yeah. The quick dial bit's missing or barely functional. A few things kind of come up as thumbnails and they kind of disappear. Certainly don't get the choice of 9. And there's very little to configure.
Right. Are they still saying don't report bugs? You know, earlier they're saying don't report bugs.
No, I think it's the opposite now, yeah. Right. They actually want you to report bugs if you're going to use the alpha.
Cool.
Well, I think it's very interesting how they've actually implemented it, because it's GTK, isn't it, and WebKit.
Yeah.
But things like the QuickDial thing, how's that done? Is that some sort of canvas to just draw onto freely, I guess?
I don't know. I don't know, actually.
Well, if it were, it'd imply it would just work across platforms, but...
It looks like it's probably Windows specific.
I wonder where their focus is, though, if it is just if Mac and Linux are developing side by side pretty much. Because obviously they care a lot about Mac users, you know, they've got a lot of, I think Eric Schmitzel on the board of Apple.
Yeah, yeah.
So they care a lot. And if they are developing Mac and Linux in tandem as a cross platform port, basically a free port of Chromium, that'd be ace. It should move along quite fast.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me they've done the hard part. Filling in the blanks, you know, getting things like Flash to work is really just a small part of the whole.
Also, Computex has been going on, the fantastic show full of electronic kit in Taiwan. And fascinatingly, there's been a few announcements for ARM CPU-powered Linux netbooks going right down to a $99 price point. And they're claiming to have between 8 and 15 hours of battery life off a 3-cell battery. So...
Well, my first thought is that they're just too low power, mathematically, to be of any use. My experience with ARM CPUs, they're great for NAS devices and certain kind of low-intensive tasks.
But if you were to take... we really are in a recurring theme here, but if you were to take something like the iPhone or iPod Touch, the iPhone has an ARM CPU clocked at 400 megahertz.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's fine for web browsing. It can handle quite detailed sites.
Yeah.
And whilst playing music at the same time and various games, so...
Yeah, I mean, all credit to Apple for getting that to work. I guess it offloads a lot.
It did show 1080p decoding taking place on these devices.
That's amazing.
That is amazing.
my dual-core Linux box can't do that. Yeah.
Yeah,
I know. I mean, it's just my experience with embedded Linux running on ARM devices in the past. It's just been pretty poor.
Well, there's a new name, a new category starting to emerge for these devices now, smartbooks. Do you like that?
That's like something out of Harry Potter. You know, this makes you rawr, you need to turn to page 50.
I think if they can optimise the operating system.
Oh yeah, that's going to be very easy, isn't it?
Well, I think actually, to be fair, you know, there's a lot of work taking place getting Android to work in these things as well. So there are a lot of smart minds coming together in one place. You know, Ubuntu's backing ARM as well right now.
Yeah.
I think it's the ARML stuff. And there's a lot of work from a lot of places coming together. And it's all going into one place right now. Now, the problem we've got is that the current low resource Linux distro, Moblin, is made by Intel, who haven't really got much of a vested interest in ARM, thanks to Xscale going to Marvel.
Oh, yeah.
That's a bit of a problem. We've got this wonderful hardware base appearing, got this wonderful software appearing, and there's a big wall between them. So perhaps these other guys, Canonical and stuff, can do something to bridge that.
And that's all the news.
Our hot topic this fortnight is inspired by the comments made by Google Chrome developer Ben Guja. He was also the lead developer on Firefox, so when he talks about development, we should probably prick up our ears and listen. But he, a while ago, he complained that Linux is difficult to develop for. There's no standard UE toolkit, apparently, and other things that I don't really understand are hard.
No, that's all you need to understand.
Well, he famously called it a cluster something. You can imagine what the second word is.
He called it a fuster clock.
A fuster clock.
A cluster book. The opposite of smart book.
Yeah. But yeah, all the different toolkits in use, and
there's no standard way of doing anything.
Well, it boils back to the old argument of freedom again, doesn't it?
It's all about choice.
It's all about choice.
Good lord. I always keep thinking whenever I see this anonymous penguins posting on the TuxRadar podcast, something that Joe Stalin said: freedom is precious, so precious that it must be rationed, which was echoed by David Blunkett in the late 90s. But also, why not ration people's freedom? Why not make them choose a toolkit?
Well, I think choice is the right thing. I don't see why people, if one toolkit is evidently better than all the rest, then it will succeed and the others will fail. And I think that kind of thing will only happen in if there's enough choice and a free market for toolkits.
Do we agree with them? Graham, Mike, me, Paul, we've all developed Linux in the past. Graham, do you think Linux is hard to develop for?
No, I don't think it's hard to develop for, but I do have a great deal of sympathy with his argument. There's a lot of choice, and there's a lot of wasted energy, as we've talked about in the past, supporting lots of different platforms and toolkits. So I have sympathy with the argument, but no, I don't think it's difficult to develop for. I think it's actually easier to develop for. It's the reason why I started using Linux in the first place.
Okay, Mike?
Well, I've not written anything that would demand poking around in the internals of the operating system, so I've only ever written small graphical utilities. And that's not difficult, but I would imagine if I wanted to write something that was doing a lot of intensive work, you know, scouring the file system, relying on checks for hardware, then I might be a bit bamboozled by the vast array of different subsystems available.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, the reason I chose Linux is the same as Graham. I find it, because there is choice, I can get the exact combination of what I'm after. It's like, do you remember years ago there was a Salon Selectives?
Salon Glow.
You'd have A, B, C, D, E, F hair types for your shampoo, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and it was conditioner. And you'd be like, you know, I'm a B3. Which, you know, you'd buy this exact thing for your hair type, you know, it'd be wonderful. And, you know, for me, I can say, well, you know, I want GTK and I want Python. Ah! So I can have my choice of language and my choice of framework and my choice of da-da-da-da-da all in my little pathway, and it'll work too. That particular combination, PyGTK, is installed by default on any GNOME install. It just works, and that's really, really nice. Flip side is we get things like MySQL OCaml bindings, which is crazy, because you end up wasting a lot of time, or people end up wasting a lot of time, a lot of disk space being wasted, a lot of CPU space being wasted, a lot of RAM being wasted, just loading all the stuff in there, all these layers after layer after layer, and it gets very messy. So I think on the computing side, it's very bad, because you get a lot of waste. But on the, is it easy? I'd say absolutely, it's very easy, because you can choose exactly what you want.
You're just not sure that everybody will have that.
Correct, that's the problem.
If I remember seeing what looked to be a really good tennis game for Linux ages ago, and it was written in something like OCaml SDL. It was some completely bizarre combination. I did legitimately try to get it to work, but I gave up after about an hour.
All of those hair products were presumably the same inside each bottle, and it was just a marketing campaign.
Allegedly. We are not levelling those sort of...
Well, you don't get them anymore, do you?
No, yeah.
It's fascinating that some people actively choose to take two bottles into the shower.
So I think it's easy to develop Linux, if you can find what works for you. But then, you know, to be fair, GTK, I think, is a nightmare to program for. I've done some GTK recently, and it's absolutely horrible. It does my head in.
I suppose the opposite is Apple. I mean, they're able to put an awful lot of effort into a single developer's framework that everybody can take advantage of. You get things like the Apple Store, a single hardware platform, and I guess that's where Ben Gujar is thinking we're losing out, because if we did have a unified front, we'll be able to compete with those kind of things easier.
But then we'd have Objective-C.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's a good
thing. I reckon by the next podcast, you'll have learned to quite like Objective-C.
Yeah, I think I like Python before I like Objective-C. Yeah, that's the problem. See, in Apple, you've got one toolkit and you've got one language. And obviously, someone has made other bindings for it, but Apple strongly encourages people to use their way, their choices. And their choices aren't very good. And that's a shame, because you know it means it is easier to develop on Windows. It is easier to develop on Linux in comparison.
Yeah, yeah.
And they suffer for that. If Linux tried that, good grief, we'd have no chance. If we said, listen, you know, you have to use C or nothing, it would die very quickly. No one would be interested. And this is very well demonstrated by the GTK guys, because for a while there, they were looking for a new language for GNOME, and I think Red Hat was saying Java, Uncle was saying Python, and then Novell was saying, hey, use C# Mono.
Yeah.
And they were all saying, hey, use this new high-level language. And everyone had their own thoughts, and every one of them was a great choice, and it could have gone any way.
Yeah.
I think in the end they chose all three, which is the standard Linux choice.
Yeah, yeah. Which I guess is the conclusion we're saying for this, really. You know, that's just the nature of the beast.
That's the power.
Yeah. That's why Linux exists.
So we're now halfway through this charade. Still to come is our open ballot on licenses. Do we need fewer of them? And, of course, our discovery of the week. Just the other way around.
Okay, so discovery of the week comes up first. Who shall I pick? Mike, have you got a discovery of the week?
I was furthest away from the microphone. I do, in fact, have a discovery of the week or fortnight. BleachBit. BleachBit is a program that claims to delete unnecessary files and free valuable disk space, maintain privacy and remove junk. And we've seen lots of programs like this for Windows over the years, and to a lesser extent Mac OS X. You know, claim to go through and remove all temporary internet files from your system.
Never trusted them.
No, but I looked into this one and tried it out, and it's actually, it's surprisingly good, because there is a lot of clutter that you wouldn't imagine is there in your Linux file system. You know, all the hidden files and hidden directories in your home directory. They can be full of stuff.
Awful, yeah.
It's awful.
It is awful.
And, you know, you go into, like, .macromedia and you find, you know, 20 megs of just old junk files that I didn't necessarily need. So this program goes through. It supports a huge number of programs that it can clean up. Like Chromium already, Epiphany Firefox, Flash, Google Earth, Java, KDE, Opera, RealPlayer. So it can go around and just, if you're short of disk space.
It removes KDE.
It removes that piece of unnecessary clutter, yeah. And it installs XFCE instead. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. Bleachbit.sourceforge.net.
That does sound good. How does that ensure it doesn't delete anything valuable?
I don't know.
RM-RM.
That's all it is just front end to that. So, yeah, use with caution, obviously.
Paul?
My one is something I made myself, which is a discovery of the week, born by lots of pain in programming. It's called Gloss, and I put it on TuxRadar recently because I'm so very proud of it and want to release it to the whole world. It is an OpenGL wrapper for Pygame. Now, someone on the Pygame site said, all these things Gloss does, Pygame does already, and that's absolutely true. What Gloss does is it makes it very easy to use OpenGL in Pygame. You don't have to use GL blah 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 calls. You just say, draw me this texture, draw me this texture, draw me this texture, just like you do in Pygame. Except because it's done on the GPU rather than the CPU, you can rotate, you can scale, you can make them transparent, you can do what you like. Instantly, on the fly, in real time. Very, very fast. And I've thrown in there as extras, I've thrown in frame buffer objects, render targets basically, so you can render it into a texture and then use that texture elsewhere. I've put particle systems in there and this kind of thing, and lots of mathematics calls for doing things like lerping, which is a common thing you want to do in games. So it's a very cool library, it's under the GPL3, and it's on TuxRadar right now, and it's great.
And how much are your support services for this then?
It's completely free. Completely free.
I've
already received my first patch.
Wow.
From Matthias Weber.
Well, what's the patch do?
Adds joystick support.
Ah, great.
Which is cool, yeah. It all works.
What version number have you given?
0.5.
0.5, a lovely, perfect kind of middle.
Well, the thing is, yeah, it's basically finished. I don't plan to do any more work on it. It's good. You can make games for it right now. But I figured there might be some bugs here and there. So I'll leave it away from 1.0 for the time being. But it's basically 1.0 release candidate 1, was what it is, waiting for the world to try it out.
Why did you develop it?
Because I've done some XNA coding in the past, which is Microsoft's toolkit for doing Xbox stuff. And it's very cool because it does let you... It basically, you write 2D games, is what it looks like.
Yeah,
behind
the
scenes, it's done on the GPU. So it's very, very fast to do cool effects. And Pygame doesn't have that. You have to use GL yourself, which is very, very painful to do.
Right, yeah.
So I've basically taken the best bits of XNA and ported them to Python, pretty much, in OpenGL. And it works.
So how difficult would it be to port a standard SDL bitmap game in Pygame to
really,
using
really
Gloss?
Easy. Really, really easy. It's almost identical. If you wanted to, you could probably do it in a few minutes.
Oh, that's good.
Because you could even write your own little wrapper to use the exact same Pygame function call.
Right. Yeah.
Doesn't really matter, but it's basically free to use. And yet you get all this great power. it's much faster than all the Pygame. It's much cooler. You can do more special effects. So go ahead and use it. I really recommend people at least try it and see what they think.
Okay, cool.
And it's in Python.
So you've learned to love Python.
No, I haven't. I still don't like Python.
Has your opinion changed at all, though? Are you more...
Last night, I did some more Objective-C. And since then, my opinion of Python has improved drastically. Because Objective-C is so very, very bad. But, you know, I've written... The actual Gloss itself is about 1,000 lines of Python. Plus the examples, about 1,500 lines in total. And I still don't like Python.
That sounds quite efficient, considering what it does. 1,000 lines of code.
Yeah, of course it is.
That's because Python's wonderful.
No, it's not wonderful. It's really nasty. I'm not going to go into it, but there were some major problems I encountered along the way with the way Python works. Things like properties were very, very painful.
Switch statement.
I'm fine with that. I'm over that now. I'm over that now. Things like default parameter values screwed me over quite nicely. But yeah, properties were a real painful thing because they changed implementation slightly in 2.6, which is one I was using. So it didn't work in 2.5 originally.
But that's one of the great features of Gloss, isn't it? The default parameter values.
It's amazing, yeah. But I had to work around a problem I found in Python to make them work nicely. But yeah, that's cool because the default parameter values are cool because you can just say draw texture at 0, 0 and it'll just draw it. Then you can go, actually no, scale it 2.0 times. Rotate it this much, and you can add bits to make it do more and more, which is cool. But by default, like Pygame, just draw it there, just draw it there, just draw it there. It's cool.
Great, thanks. Shall I go first, Andrew? Give you some more thinking time.
Yeah.
Well, my discovery of the week is expensive. What? Yeah, discovery of the fortnight. In fact, it's €249.
I can't afford that.
It's a commercial. Sound generating thing for Linux. It's called Pianotech. It's a mathematically modelled piano. And the most important thing about it is it sounds absolutely wonderful. And there's been an OS X and Windows version of this product for a few years. And they've released a Linux version. Cool. Amazing. It's a standalone piece of software that plugs into Jack. It takes MIDI notes from your MIDI interface, your MIDI keyboard. And because it's so much money, it's worth having a decent weighted MIDI keyboard. And it translates those MIDI notes into piano notes by calculating all the acoustic properties of a real piano. And it sounds absolutely wonderful. It sounds so much better than even a large sample.
That's what I was just going to ask. What is the benefit of using samples?
There are lots of advantages. With a sample piano, they sound very good, but there are certain limitations. One of them is that there are only a maximum of 128 different velocities for a sample piano, and most sample libraries cut that by a half or a quarter or an eighth, so you might only get 4 or 8 variations in velocity, the speed that you hit a piano key. But most importantly, you lose the interaction, the resonances, between more than one key playing at once. You can't possibly sample every possible combination of piano keys being pressed down, whereas a mathematically modelled piano can do exactly that, and also the effect of the reverberation on the case. And you can change all of these parameters. You can invent your own piano, if you like. And they've also extended the model to include electric pianos, and vibraphones.
What about the, you know, the best, the proper keyboard instrument, the harpsichord?
No, they haven't done harpsichord.
Or clavichord.
I guess.
It's there's one velocity of that, isn't there? Really?
It seems, I'm surprised, but there must be a reason why a plucking string model is going to be far more complicated. I don't know.
So it's €249.
Yeah, it is.
Is it about 100K? 100 kilobytes?
it's about 8 meg. Which is, thing, yeah, right. Yeah. And really,
down
you can
what
download
samples?
The...
I mean, what samples be in comparison?
A decent piano library is several gigabytes.
Saving then, really.
And also on top of that, you need a decent spec computer to run a decent sample library, because you've got to have the memory to hold the beginnings of all those samples. You've got to have a hard disk that can keep up with streaming it. Whereas this is, it needs a modern CPU, but it's not CPU intensive. But the sound is just phenomenal. And okay, it's expensive, but Roland, for example, the big synth manufacturer, has just created a standalone virtual piano using similar modeling techniques, and their piano costs something like £3,000 or £4,000. So if you use this in combination with a decent weighted keyboard, you've got a great piano on your Linux box.
And can't you get one in for review?
In fact, that's exactly what I have done.
Hey, amazing. €50 saved.
Yep. But yeah, it's great. Andrew?
Yeah, I went to a festival a couple of weeks ago in Bristol, but I really wanted to go see the whole Steady, but they were on too late for me. I had to leave at 9 o'clock because I got tired, because I'm now getting old. I suppose technically I've always been getting old. Yeah.
From your perspective?
Well, yeah. Oh, just in terms of maths.
there might be some, you know, the center of a black hole.
Diet, yeah. But no, so to make up for not seeing them live, I downloaded their album Stay Positive, and hence discovered that the media keys on my laptop work in Linux but don't work in Windows. What's that all about?
What's the deal with your idea?
I don't know, but I don't know. I don't care. It just means that I don't. It's just one less thing I do on Windows.
Media keys, what do you mean?
The stuff on the front of the laptop, like play, oh, and fast forward.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Those.
They work on Linux.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
But they don't work on Windows. But they didn't used to work on Linux. Like,
yeah, they have got better at it. Yeah. All mine work now, randomly, in Ubuntu 9.04.
Yeah.
It's like X_play or something like that. It signs like a special key. X media play, sorry. It gives it a name like that, which is quite useful.
It worked in the last SUSE version I tried. What else did it work on?
Turbo Linux?
It didn't work on Turbo Linux. but I think I've got to install a big bunch of drivers and stuff to make things work properly on Windows.
From Dell's terrible website.
Yeah, it's like, what a pain.
How's your trackpad? Is it all right?
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine in both. I never realised that Windows was such a pain to install.
Thanks.
Thanks. You're welcome. Yeah. Good work organising the section, Graham.
Yeah.
Okay, let's depart from the sunny shores of Discovery of the Fortnight and set sail for Open Ballot, where the topic is, do we need fewer open source licenses? Or is choice good?
Choice!
Does it respect my freedom?
Choice is awesome.
What do you think, guys?
I love choice, me.
Can't get enough of it.
In choice, brilliant.
I don't always trust myself to make the right decision, though. I'd rather someone else made it for me.
That's why I chose a BSD license for my Quest, because it's the simplest thing. People, I got loads of complaints. People say, oh, you should use GPL. You're a Linux fan, use GPL. And I just thought, no, I want something that's small as possible, in file size.
People complain to you about your license choice.
Yeah.
Bugger off! I've written some code, I'm giving it to you free, you can't complain.
I know.
Isn't that what the man with a really long name said?
No, I'm sorry, you're doing the different section now. You're doing Discovery of the Fortnight. Clear off. That's mine now.
I'm Discovery of the Fortnight.
But I started looking at Open Ballot for about 20 minutes before you told me that I was doing Hot Topic.
All right. So, Morten Jul Johansson Zelde Feher, he said...
That guy.
MJJZF, who comments regularly, he's a really nice guy, it seems. He said... the free software movement and the Creative Commons project have made us aware that licensing is the right of the author. While it can be fairly complex to make sure whether the licenses are compatible, it is an aspect of free software and culture. If I write software, a novel, or put out a piece of music, I decide what the rights of the user are, so my word to the user is, deal with it.
Hear, hear.
I agree with him, but it's too complex, isn't it? It'd be nice if the FSF could be an umbrella for open source software licenses, so you just say an open source license.
Yeah, they'd like that, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah.
open source, you know that.
No, but that's what it needs, because I'm confused a lot of the time. You look for the term open source license, and then the details you can worry about if you need to worry about.
But just yesterday, me and Graham were trying to find some textures.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay? All the time, I want to find people who can make textures to make games with, okay? And they're really rare. So I thought, well, I'll look on Alien Arena, because Alien Arena is a free GPL licensed game, because I want some textures. And it turns out Alien Arena, the source code is free, but all the textures, all the sounds, all the models are not free. You can't redistribute them outside of Alien Arena.
You can redistribute them if you distribute in the game.
You can only distribute them as one bundle as part of Alien Arena.
Right.
So you can't say, oh, that crate texture is great, I want that one. You can't have that. You can't share that. Only within Alien Arena, which is not free software. And people say, oh, yeah, it's a great GPL game. No, it's not a great GPL game. It's a great GPL chunk of source code, which is useless without graphics. It's worth nothing. This is why we haven't got Quake 3 totally free software, because just the source code isn't enough. You need all the models, all the assets. I'm always looking for spriters. Seriously, if you're a spriter, I will pay you to make GPL graphics. Please email me at paulhudson@futurenet.com. I will pay you to make graphics. That's my plea. So it's not. It's really sad. It's really confused. You know, people are screwing with licenses.
That situation is dreadful because, you know, Debian has Alien Arena included in the repository, Ubuntu.
Really?
Yeah. And it's not open source.
Is it mixed
by any stretch? I don't actually know why.
Mongrel source.
The source code is open. Yeah. That's the problem. Open source. It's open source.
But you've got to include the media data as the part of the source.
You do. And I think Nexu is the other Alien Arena alike does, and they point to it. You know, it's a free source and data. It says that on the front page, if I remember correctly. They're really open about it because they're aware Alien Arena isn't that at all.
Why are the artists so precious about it?
I don't know. That's the thing. You know, you look around. How much open source code is there now? Squadrillions of lines.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything I do is GPL. You do GPL. You do BSD. It doesn't really matter. There's loads of stuff out there. And for some reason, artists, apart from, and the major exception is icon makers, who seem very friendly, most artists say, oh no, you can't use my work. It's very precious. You can't have it.
Yeah, yeah.
Come on, guys. Help us out. Help everyone out.
Well. Also, it helps you build up a portfolio if you release graphics for free, doesn't it? Because it means other people use them in their games. And then you can say, my graphics were used in these five games.
Five great games.
Instead of limiting yourself to one. Yeah.
I've seen someone say a few months ago that they're thinking about opening some sort of free software texture library. I pray to God that happens. I'll fund it personally if I have to. Because I need them so badly, and it's a shame we haven't got anything like that.
So you haven't had good luck with open clip art then, Paul?
Open clip art. It's a project I've personally thought about forking. Because the website is that bad. You try and search for, like, spaceship, and it finds user called spaceship.
Yeah, or comment.
Who cares what his username is? I don't care for his username. I want to find clip art about spaceships. So whatever you want, you just never find anything useful.
There's some good penguin SVG images in there.
And there are some real horrors in there too. Anyway, it's
that's why we get so many games with penguins in there.
Jack the Hat said, maybe have one license with optional parts to it, or would that just complicate matters? Having a core license with modules that can be added to customise to suit your individual needs might be a better way of going about things.
And then we could have a license that has dependencies as well.
That depend on different parts of each other. Yeah. So they have recursive dependencies.
At last, the circle is complete.
Yeah, I think, Jack, that might prove rather complicated. Although that is kind of the basis of Creative Commons, isn't it? It is basically a core license with bits you add on.
But that is really complicated, Creative Commons.
Is it? If someone says to you, you know, NC BY...
Well, it's so complicated that our legal people at Future have advised us not to use Creative Commons licenses because they don't understand them.
I know. Despite them having cartoons about it, a little comic book saying, this is what Creative Commons means in pictures!
Or your fancy degrees, this is the best you can come up with.
But for the normal user, I think, yeah, it muddies the waters. And even if Creative Commons sort of license stuff could just be said to be open source, it would make things a lot easier.
You think you just care?
Well, they should do in a world that's becoming increasingly restricted in terms of what we can and can't do with media.
Well, let me read you a comment from the real David Field. It says, your question starts with a comment. This is on the website. Everyone knows the GPL and what it stands for. That's what he said on the website. I don't believe that to be true, at a user level at the very least, as Linux extends itself into the user world, and, as you have previously looked at, starts to chip into the Windows user world too, the average user is caring less and less about the license and more about the software being free of charge. Which, whether it's MIT, BSD, GPL, it's free of charge.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's probably got a very good point. Free is why a lot of people are beginning to use Linux and things like OpenOffice.org. But they still need to be. There still needs to be some kind of guarantee that it is free and that it will remain free for most of us to use it. Without actually understanding every line of the license or whatever the license is.
But has anyone here actually reused the GPL code? Because I mean, GPL is, you know, if you see something like yours, you can kind of copy and paste it into your stuff, attribute it GPL with GPL2.
Yeah, I have done. I've used other people's widgets and things like that, like where I've just copied and pasted their code into mine.
And you have to mark the copyright or something in there?
I have done. I've credited them and included their license information.
And did you have to check around first to find the right license beforehand?
To make it easy, I just looked for GPL stuff, the same license I was using. I wouldn't want to get into the minefield of trying to deal with two separate licenses.
Yeah.
Well,
that's the problem is that from a developer's point of view, it is a minefield. Users say, no money, great.
Yeah.
Developers go, I want to use the code, but I can't because the license is ever so slightly different. You know, we're trying to accomplish the same thing. We're trying to get to the same end position, but we can't because we're fighting about licenses or not able to use stuff, just can't use it. You know, BSD and GPL, you can't, they don't cross.
Yeah.
Ollie says, it shouldn't be arbitrary, but the strongest should survive. The Open Source Foundation should be comparing each proposed license to existing licenses and, where they are practically the same, make mergers or updates to existing licenses in consultation with the community so there aren't redundant licenses. What do you think, Mike?
That sounds canny to me, like.
Strongest? Survival of the fittest? The licenses?
Yeah, I think the vast majority of people choose GPL or BSD, don't they? So I think
Apache?
Yeah, and the Apache MIT licenses, but, you know, pulling numbers out of thin air, but you look at SourceForge and FreshMeat, and I think most people are choosing BSD, GPL. It's only really a small number of licenses, I think, causes complication.
I think the problem with the Apache license is, and it's not Apache's fault, it's that a lot of other projects have taken it, replaced Apache to say PHP or whatever it is have done, and call that the PHP license.
Yes,
basically the same license, but now it's called the PHP license, and that's on the thing. And you have to at least think, oh, what is that, and then read the license quickly to know it's the Apache license.
Yeah, you have to kind of know the families, don't you, in the background behind it all.
Yeah, I think that's why Sun tried to make. I think they took the Mozilla public license.
MPL, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and then took Mozilla out of it and made it unique, you know, generic to every product and released it as a Sun license.
Yeah.
Which is a good idea, I think. That's what you should see more of that kind of thing. Stato said, again, survival of the fittest is what thins the numbers of anything, but not arbitrary decisions by people, regardless of how well-intentioned they are. And that raises the question, do we trust the Open Source Foundation to be the ones to choose which licenses are there or not? Because right now the rules are in place. They accept a license if it's A, B, C, and D. Anything comes in, they accept it after a process and put it in. Whereas, you know, Ollie's idea is to start having them thin things down by merging licenses together. Do we trust them?
I think we've got to trust somebody. I think it's a good idea. I think merging licenses and trying to reduce the pool of licenses that are out there is a good idea. So somebody has to do it.
Ages ago, I wrote a piece for Linux Format called the Linux Diaries, if you remember it.
Yeah.
It was a diary from the future. And the last part, I think, was where Richard Stallman quit the FSF to join Microsoft. But his last action in the FSF was to release a GPL4, which basically made all the code public domain. Because all the licenses say GPL2 or later, or 3 or later, so GPL4 replaced that open source code. Because we are effectively trusting them. And I know the kernel doesn't say all later, but most projects do say all later.
Yeah.
We are trusting them to with our licensing for the future, basically. So we do trust someone, but I don't really mind trusting the FSF for some reason, whereas I have a problem trusting another.
Well, source. Yeah, the FSF take a very kind of like vigilant approach to it.
Exactly.
They get on some people's nerves. But, yeah, I trust them with licensing, even if they're very picky about it.
Well, none of us are lawyers either, so how do we really know what is and isn't possible through the wording in a license? No, I have no idea.
That's why I like the BSD license, because you can just read it and understand it straight away on the spot. It's very, very simple.
It is the best license in terms of readability. The GPL is much longer. And it's getting longer, too.
you do need a certain degree of legal knowledge to be able to fully pass the GPL.
That's why I like the CC's pictures.
Yeah, Creative Commons, it has
can you use them in a court of law, though? Look, I was doing this.
Also, the way the CC has the XML definitions as well, so that browsers can display, if it's a CC page, it'll say, you know, little dollar through, you can't use the commercial levers. You can see in your browser everywhere you go. That's what it means.
Yeah.
And understood by machines, by lawyers, and by people, which is very cool.
Yeah.
And actually, that'd be a great feature for something like KDevelop, which is always looking to add new features. If someone defined, you know, a set of licensed XML things, what you can and can't do, and you'd say, hey, my project's GPL. So when you say, you know, import this project, it would go, well, that's LGPL, you can use that.
Yeah.
But this was MIT, well, that's a bit of a problem, MIT, you have to do this and this, or whatever. It recognised the licenses being imported.
Just thinking that through, you can see how complicated it would be, wouldn't it?
Well, no, because it's like CVS revision tags, you know, dollars, LGPL, whatever it be.
Yeah, the implementation, fine, but actually trying to work out which licenses are compatible, how it all kind of fits in.
The FSF does know, they keep track of which ones are free, don't they?
Yeah.
We consider these to be GPL compatible and free. These are GPL incompatible but still free, or da 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 da. So they do say what they are, and you could start with that list.
Yeah.
I think most KDE things are GPL, aren't they?
Yeah.
And backends
is
LGPL. So that's KDE basically covered. Hear that, KDE developed guys? I'm trying to help you out, you see?
I think that's the least of their worries.
And with that particularly open ballot, that brings us to the end of our discussion and the end of our podcast.
Look at that spider on the wall. Look.
What spider?
Ah, fooled you, Paul. This gives me a chance to do my one more thing. I think you'll find this one very valuable, actually, Paul.
There's no spider.
Oh, it ran away. It's run into your bag over there. I've noticed that when you've got the command line open, Paul, and you do your commands, type it away, and then to leave, you type exit. Four key presses. It's interesting. So, but because you as an advanced Linux user aren't aware of the shortcut I'm going to give, maybe some other readers don't as well. You can press Control and D, that's right, Control and D, and it will close your terminal window nice and quick. It's just...
That's amazing.
Yes.
That's really good.
Do you type exit or do you...
I don't know.
Do you Control and D? Or do you Alt and F4?
I do Control and D.
Right. Good work, Ray.
Or I just leave it open.
Just like pile up. Do you think you're going to use Control and D from here onwards, Paul?
So, since you mentioned this to me about 4 weeks ago, I have been trying to do it. I really have. Again, it's a muscle memory issue.
Yeah.
Exit, enter. It's natural for me. I'm going to type really fast. So I'm trying. Control D, Control D, Control D. And I've even made myself, if I type exit, enter, I force myself to open a new terminal and press Control D.
Like an alias.
Yeah. So, yeah. No, I admit, as a penalty for doing it, I make myself do it to try and get used to doing Control D. I will do it sooner or later.
It's the future.
And with that, we come to the real end of our podcast. Don't forget the fantastic subscription deal to the Linux Format Magazine at tinyurl.com/podcastlxf. It's super cheap, and Americans, be careful. The exchange rate is changing in against your favour, actually. So subscribe sooner rather than later to get maximum savings. All the notes for this podcast are, of course, on Tux Radar. And I think right now we've got a new special edition magazine, haven't we?
We have. Switch to Linux.
Switch to Linux. It's amazing. It's on sale worldwide right now. It's designed for sort of newbies / almost newbies. So if you're in your first year of using Linux, we recommend you go and grab a copy from your local shop, or you can buy it online, I think. Look around. And it's really, really good. It's 130 pages, approximately.
It is, yep. Yeah. And it comes with, obviously, with a full installable version of Linux.
Exactly. And you can buy it for your friends and give it to them, and they'll love Linux too.
Convert the world.
Yep. So tune in 2 weeks' time, and you'll hear some more of this nonsense. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. It's such a nice day to be on the main stage, all class skipping. Say